Welcome to Women's Work. Thanks for spending some time with us as we get to know or try to get to know some extremely accomplished women who may not have gotten to the modern spotlight. Our job is to try to change that, one interview at a time. I'm your host, Leslie Gray, and today we intend to talk to a dynamo of 19th century humanitarianism, Dorothea Lynn Dix. Her efforts to provide government-sponsored facilities for the mentally ill in antebellum America and abroad are remarkable during a period when women were not even allowed to set foot in houses of government. I think I'd better mention that the terminology for mental illness and related medicine in those days was very different, so please do not be offended by certain diction my guest may use. That being said, let's see how our little Tesseractatron chrono-reduction apparatus is doing. Oh, we realized that there actually was a component we left out. We found it last week in the bottom of the box the apparatus arrived in. So John got it properly installed. You called it some kind of filter, right, John? So first I turn this to this setting to get it started. Okay, move this to the blue line. Okay, all right. So we got the parameters, and these coordinates look like they are... John, are these the settings you... Where? Oh, this one here? Okay. Our sincere thanks to the Jalen Meadows Stevens Institute and their generous technicians willing to unload some non-essential so we can do this. Okay, connecting...
No, not the cornice. The mantelpiece here at the fireplace.
Hello, Miss Dix? Miss Dorothea Dix?
Yes, I am inside the main sitting room, and this...
Oh!
They've obviously learned how to use the cricket bats. Thank you for checking, Jeffrey. I shall be fine here.
Miss Dix, are you able to hear us?
This is the section of molding that I was directed to speak into.
Yes, Miss Dix, you are in the absolute correct position.
This elaborate indication of position has a purpose.
Yes, Miss Dix, our apologies. That bit of molding was what the Chrono Reduct Act chose.
To cooperate with this extremely odd request, I must stand facing the fireplace.
Oh, I think there's a chair, Miss Dix. Right, John? Yes, please go ahead and make yourself comfortable if you can, Miss Dix.
I am very used to refraining from comfort.
But we can hear you much better seated. You can hear me, yes?
I can hear you perfectly well. And as I said, I shall attempt to engage in this interview. However much I must state clearly, I am disinclined to elaborate about myself.
Oh, but your contributions to humanitarian reform are appreciated so much that even a moment of your time would be inspirational for so many people.
Some use may be derived, then, if my strivings will be of example to others.
Absolutely. Now, your life's work was on behalf of the mentally ill.
They cried out from chains in almshouses and prisons, caged and bereft of even the minimal comforts that farm animals enjoy. I have merely tried to give them aid.
Well, not something for the faint of heart.
My own youthful training in endurance and suffering left me fully equipped to accept this task.
As a child,
there is no point nor tolerance in detailing what was merely preparation for my eventual vocation. The days of childhood are better categorized as inconsequential scars of hard labor, tutelage for the coming austerities. You will ask me how I came to inspect the madhouses.
Okay, I was going to,
Education was my initial path. I was eager for fruitful work and believed my calling would be revealed, so I remained vigilant, expectant. Teaching was the very first, inspired by my being with my grandmother in Boston.
Oh, your grandmother,
However, we shall not discuss my grandmother. Only to say that her imposing personality succeeded in eradicating any frivolousness I may have possessed. And my inheritance from her guaranteed me the freedom to pursue the spiritual duty required.
Okay. You wrote one of the first teacher instruction manuals at the age of 22.
There was a dearth of moral curriculum. The average woman attempting to teach young children lacked resources to do this properly, and I designed exactly the type of lessons required to mold a mature conscience. I wrote Conversations on Common Things using a mother-child dialogue to exemplify how good parents would nurture such children.
And bad parents?
Are the most contemptible of society's reprobates.
Oh.
My books were extremely popular.
The first was in 1824.
As was my Hymns for Children the following year.
These books reflect your Unitarian approach to education.
All children of God are entitled to learn.
But weren't you raised in the Methodist tradition?
As with many circumstances of birth, one can escape the confines of upbringing. I am privileged to know many great thinkers, Congregationalist, Quaker, as well as Unitarian, and extraordinary teachers such as Reverend Channing.
William Ellery Channing. You accompanied the family to St. Croix in the Virgin Islands.
Excuse me?
St. Croix, Dutch West Indies.
Oh, quite so. I was their governess. Reverend Channing's influence broadened my understanding of God's oneness and our mutual human bond. And experiencing life there on the island, a turning of unfurrowed soil for me.
How so?
You intend to probe about my views on slavery, that haughty crime of privilege. Of course. There were 240 African slaves on the Mount Victory plantation where we stayed. So, yes, I was surrounded by images of crippling labor, the cruel punishment and fierce debasement endured by these people for the benefit of the white owners. No blessing, no good can follow in the path trodden by this evil agency. However, I remind you that young eyes absorb quite different details than older ones. Mm. And I channeled my energies into documenting my observances as scientific descriptions of incidents and factors, as I also documented the unique flora and fauna I discovered there.
You made notes on the biology of the slaves?
I shall explain. I was already absorbed in the study of the natural sciences and had categorized minerals, plants, insects, the like, in the Boston Athenaeum, even corresponding with the renowned naturalist Benjamin Silliman.
Oh.
It was he who encouraged me to use my time on St. Croix as an opportunity to gather island specimen and expand my understanding of the natural world.
I see, but...
I kept a log with details I observed about the slaves, their strength, the labor itself, their interactions with each other and with their owners, how they lived in their huts, the food they were provided, their clothing, their speech, and yes, their suffering, the manacles, the flogging, although some of these sites were shielded from me, being unfit for female view.
But you knew about them,
Reverend Channing's descriptions were vivid enough. I was not in a position to alter circumstances. But I believe a foundation was formed in my heart on which to build the edifice of my life's work. I had only to wait for God to present the opportunity to be his instrument.
And was that opportunity your inspection of the East Cambridge jail 15 years later?
Are you attempting a mere publicity article?
No. This is your interview, Miss Dix. No, we just have facts from your accomplishments and...
Obviously, every journalist must do research, but I expected to delineate my own selection of topics.
Absolutely. I was only just...
My discovery at the Middlesex County Jail in East Cambridge...
Massachusetts?
East Cambridge, Massachusetts, was a shocking revelation. I'd been teaching weekly Sunday school classes at the jail for the female inmates, but was informed that housed in the basement were four insane persons, whom I found kept in the foulest of conditions. It was appalling, but more significantly, it led to my realization that these sufferers of lunacy, unable to comprehend even their own bodily needs, should elicit pity and not punishment, that their care was incumbent upon us all. Society, and by default, government, in whose hands the welfare of its most destitute citizens falls. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Undeniable, this, our responsibility. I could not quiet my distress over what I had witnessed, that these unfortunates were confined in the same cell as violent criminals. It was imperative that they be removed to a professional facility designed for their needs, such as a state asylum.
At the time, the mentally ill without money were automatically placed in prisons?
Or almshouses, if not kept with their families. If patients were too disruptive to remain at home, families could pay to move them to private facilities, which were too often run by miscreants, posing as custodians of madhouses that were little more than slop pits and dungeons. There was already a new hospital, the Boston Lunatic Hospital, that had opened in 1839, which operated on the enlightened theory of moral management. And thus, those insane persons placed there, even those unable to pay for treatment, were given kindness and dignity. And with few exceptions, they were able to regain useful lives, to labor in common duties at the hospital, and return to the society that had cruelly locked them away. To see the contrast in patients that were treated humanely with dignity and bodily care, not luxury, mind you, but at standards of decency, to those cast into the abyss like refuse, in darkness, in chains, whipped and caged, to battle with their individual demons in solitary anguish, surrounded by filth and abandonment, could there be any stronger testimony to how we were to correct this atrocity? Why would we not demand reform? Facilities were needed where the insane could be placed without overcrowding and where their humanity could be restored.
Well, this new approach of humane treatment was something you yourself witnessed in England around 1836, is that right?
Yes. I was transformed by my experience in England, utterly transformed. Having arrived in the throes of my own, shall we say simply, illness, I was in need of the healing power of nature's tranquility, and receiving it at Greenbank...
Oh, the estate of the Rathbone family?
Yes, the most compassionate family that ever graced this world. William and Elizabeth were as ministering angels. I recovered my very life.
You were under extreme duress, physical exhaustion?
It was distress in soul and spirit, debilitation of my very being. I had recovered from fatigue and illness before, but this was a dark, dark disruption. I even went so far as to ask a friend to take over my little school, should I not return? But there, under the Rathbones' immense kindness, I found my heart again. And I was introduced to the concept that these distresses could be lifted, not by castigation, but by gentleness and pastoral contemplation. The model for treatment of this type, the York Retreat there in England, is a refuge with the profoundest impact on the disturbed mind, and a balm for those who might have endured such traumatic incidents as to destabilize their very temple of reason. When I returned home and saw conditions of abuse in our very midst, in our local jail, I had to act.
Well, you then began documenting prison conditions of the mentally ill across the state of Massachusetts.
I spent almost 20 months inspecting every location I could find in order to shed light on this misery we, the state, were inflicting.
Oh, and these detailed observations became the memorial to the Massachusetts legislature in 1843, yes?
Many of my notes were compiled therein. Not all, but many.
It was published to persuade Massachusetts lawmakers to earmark funding to expand the Worcester Asylum.
It was published primarily to persuade the people of Massachusetts that we needed a place to care for the insane outside of criminal incarceration.
Oh.
to influence the legislatures was a corollary function, an essential corollary, but a component of the whole.
A memorial was the only way a woman could have her concerns brought before the houses of government. Is that correct? I mean, women were not allowed to vote and were not allowed to even testify on their own.
Women were not allowed in the State House building, nor was it proper for any woman to discuss decisions of government.
Yet you had 5,000 copies of your testimony published and had them distributed.
To every lawmaker and a good portion of the population.
And it was successful?
Quite. They appropriated $25,000 in state money, as well as earmarking a special benevolent endowment of $40,000 to expand the Worcester State Asylum so it could take in the 625 pauper insane that were still at the state almshouses and prisons.
Wow, that's about, $2 million in today's money. An amazing achievement. But the memorial was also unusually graphic.
It was the wholly accurate descriptions of what I saw with my own eyes. Some would consider it graphic. However, the ghastly images and scenes I witnessed were precisely thus. The accounts in my little green leather notebook from each of the prisons and almshouses that I'd inspected were factually deplorable. I was accused of fabrication, of a gothic imagination, yet these horrors were not things to euphemize or dignify with indirect language. I chose to document the cold reality of these conditions because it was the truth. I saw human beings crusted with sores, naked, rolling in their own excrement. Female inmates carrying infants, having become pregnant and giving birth during their incarceration. That my descriptions were unpleasant to some was hardly a consideration when human lives were being thus degraded and destroyed. It was my duty, my commission from God himself, to see that these injustices ceased.
Miss Dix, this may be that new filter.
Men of Massachusetts, I beg, I implore, I demand pity and protection. Fathers, husbands, brothers, I would supplicate you for this boon. But what do I say? I dishonor you, divest you at once of Christianity and humanity. Does this appeal imply distrust? If it comes burdened with a doubt of your righteousness in this legislation, then blot it out, while I declare confidence in your honor, not less than your humanity. Here you will put away the cold, calculating spirit of selfishness and self-seeking. Lay off the armor of local strife and political opposition. Here and now, for once, forgetful of the earthly and perishable, come up to these halls and consecrate them with one heart and one mind to works of righteousness and just guardians of the solemn rights you hold in trust. Raise up the fallen, succor the desolate, restore the outcast, defend the helpless, and for your eternal and great reward, receive the benediction. Well done, good and faithful servants. Become rulers over many things.
Miss Dix, are you there, ma'am?
I believe my glorious testimony reached every ear in that great hall.
I'm assuming someone else had to read your words to the chamber.
No. No, you are correct. Decorum was upheld. My words were presented to the chamber by Mr. Howe, or his assistant. I was, of course, not present.
Samuel Gridley Howe, he was the one that encouraged you to publish it in the first place.
Yes. Once he had seen my manuscript, he was attempting one on his own, but he felt strongly that mine would be the decisive argument for our cause. He was one not adverse to a woman in the halls of government. It was fortunate that I had several very strong advocates within the chamber on my behalf, and the bill passed resoundingly.
Ah.
But my higher mission was not only for Massachusetts. I vowed to accomplish similar expansions and establishments of asylum facilities in other states and across the country as the need demanded.
You did similar inspections in other states?
The injustices were so acute that I found myself traversing several states at once just to complete my investigations.
Mm-hmm.
And as I completed one jurisdiction, it was a matter of imperative to continue into the adjoining state, madness having no compunction to remain confined within legislative borders.
You went from the eastern seaboard toward the south. I have here an account that lists, starting with Massachusetts, you went to Rhode Island, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Illinois, Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri, Maryland, Louisiana, Alabama, South Carolina, and North Carolina.
Quite accurate.
Wow, but you also went into Canada, Europe, and beyond.
I was often summoned by those from afar seeking to remedy their own country's abuses. If I was able, I would attend with diligence, not stopping at a man-made border. Onward, northward, westward, and eastward, there were more and more opportunities to shine the light of exposure into dark corners. I must emphasize, however, that in our what we might call civilized realms, there were unfathomable examples of degradation.
Uh-huh.
And in places considered unenlightened, such as some of the Mohammedan nations, conditions were humane, and patients were treated with utter kindness. So, no, our perception of a nation as being righteous or heathen mattered not. What mattered is whether they respected life and their governments prioritized caring for their citizens.
During your most intense traveling period, how many miles would you have traveled, say, in a year?
Oh, I would estimate perhaps 10,000 miles or so.
Wow, without planes or cars?
Pardon?
It had to be so difficult for a woman to travel the extent that you did, all alone, too.
I'm immensely skilled in handling difficulty. I need no comfort, nor pampering of any kind. And the hardships of travel were not of consequence given my purpose.
But the almshouses and prisons must have been in very remote, hard-to-get-to places.
Extremely remote. Mm. Townships barely acknowledged these houses of correction existed, let alone that people were incarcerated there. I often traversed stone-strewn dirt trails in wildernesses, backwoods, venturing into quite desolate areas.
Well, I would imagine sometimes you had to hire unconventional transportation?
Hacks, farmers' carts, mule-drawn wagons. I was always able to obtain some conveyance, no matter how primitive.
You must have been a fearless traveler in an age when even getting a few miles was hazardous.
A woman traveling alone was quite shocking to some. So I presented an unexpected figure in environments where a lady never ventured. A mystique that worked to my advantage in precarious encounters. Barely acknowledged these houses of correction existed. And having accustomed myself to sleep in the meanest of circumstances, I always arrived at my intended destinations.
You were known for surprising prison officials with your visits.
There was much to document, and much that would be hidden without direct observation.
These inspections, and your making them public, were influential in establishing a lot of state-funded facilities for patients. You helped establish, I believe, 32 hospitals?
Yes. I was warmly informed by the illustrious Dr. Thomas Story Kirkbride that I would be honored by the Association of Medical Superintendents.
Wow, in 1849?
He was the renowned superintendent of the Pennsylvania Hospital for the Insane and was my indispensable consultant for the construction and best practices of the state lunatic hospital I just succeeded in establishing in Harrisburg. It meant so much to me to retain the friendship and esteem of intelligent persons whose position and abilities qualify them peculiarly to comprehend and judge the vocation to which my energies have been devoted.
Oh, you had to be very politically savvy at a time when women had limited access to the political realm. How did you...
I learned early on that in order to free government purse strings, politics is required. And no facility can be seen to completion without funding. So it was imperative to place myself in the midst of those influencing decisions and to learn the ways of leveraging to obtain our goals. For example, with the Harrisburg Hospital I mentioned, I was made aware that even after the legislature, in response to my endeavors, had set aside adequate funds, 3 years later, there was still no hospital. I had to adjust my schedule and return to Pennsylvania to root out the cause, and found that it was due to a reluctance to present lunacy as a public issue.
What did you do?
I simply confronted these men with the extremely effective threat of making their neglect of duty very public. Since I was well known to all the newspaper editors and reputable families. At the prospect of my exposing their lack of integrity, they quailed. To ensure no continued dereliction, I myself offered to identify a qualified superintendent for the new facility, as well as personally oversee the construction to guarantee it remained within budget. Naturally, as I befriended more and more of the burgeoning ranks of alienists, I was requested to use my influence to find them positions at my hospitals.
Just for clarification, the term alienist...
Asylum physicians. Medical doctors whose specialty is working with lunacy in patients. To change public sentiment, which viewed insanity as moral decrepitude or hidden sin, such unenlightened views as these, to seeing it a sickness like cancer or consumption, treatable by medical means and in no way reflective of the sufferer's virtue or value, this was a formidable challenge. Qualified alienists elevated the field to one of respected science, reasonably seeking a cure rather than an exercise in restraint relying on medieval instruments of punishment. Do you use a different term in your region?
Yes, we call them psychiatrists, medical professionals who work with mental illness.
Yes, mental illness. That is exact. A precise term. Definition of illness is specific. I approve of this term.
Great. So these alienists, they were men.
Naturally, they are men.
But you might like a woman to eventually...
That would require an extraordinary woman. A medical doctor such as Miss Elizabeth Blackwell, certainly attainable. But an alienist? Indeed, a superintendent? I suspect those women eligible for such prospects would need to be unencumbered by the usual societal burdens, inordinately intelligent, possessing incredible perseverance strength, and of the utmost moral fortitude.
Such as yourself?
I was aided by my situation and my work habits. My interactions within the circles of asylum superintendents, their prodigies, as well as social reformers, led to my constantly being consulted for my recommendations about all aspects of asylum building, maintaining facilities, staffing, treatment. So I took it upon myself to study architectural articles and medical treatises. I sought information and equally sought people who knew answers. I left few stones unturned, and thus I was considered an authority.
Well, so do you feel your efforts to secure a federal bill for setting aside land and funding for hospitals across the country was seen as an expert recommendation rather than...
A woman's? Yes, that is possible. My many friends in Congress strongly supported my proposal, a system of national hospitals. Mm. Both houses passed the measure without much debate. However, nothing is straightforward in Washington. Governmental rituals required interminable discussions of policy perspectives and inconsequences. So much to be done, and they were slow. Too slow to seize the moment.
It was stalled for...
For 10 years. The amount of patient endurance I expended. Eternities with congressional stakeholders, convincing, defending, maintaining composure at self-serving arguments. No more evident need could be elucidated, and yet...
Eventually the bill was...
Vetoed. Heartlessly, like the cruel bite of a viper. By Franklin Pierce, a poor hollow of a man.
Oh, that was in 1854.
I could not have foreseen the factionalism, the intensity of partisanship that was splitting the country. That there was a delegation of lawmakers eager to carve up the nation was beyond my ability to fathom.
The Confederacy.
That a president could render his office a mere sycophancy to a small, reckless contingent of warmongers is deplorable.
Oh.
The government's sole purpose is to see to the welfare of the people of this nation. All the people. Not merely those landed or those with political connections or with convenient business investments that would be upset by the appropriation of federal lands. No. Should there not be more integrity in a president of these United States?
Absolutely.
The rebellion destroyed any hope for creating national hospitals. Which is why I chose to offer my services toward a different aim as soon as conflict broke out.
You took on coordinating the nurses' corps for the Union during the Civil War, rebellion.
I did. I knew that there would be an immediate need for hiring and dispatching nurses to care for the wounded. And I was determined to have female nurses allowed to serve in the military hospitals.
There were female nurses employed in the asylums?
For many years. Their efficiency and innate kindness would be foolish to disregard. The few army nurses in the battlefield hospitals were recovering soldiers, hardly able to assist the severely wounded. I knew women would be invaluable as nurses, a much-needed resource, but likely underutilized.
So when you were officially appointed superintendent of women nurses in 1861...
My appointment was not immediate. At first, I merely proposed to the War Department in Washington that I would organize an Army Corps of nurses made up of women volunteers. The military hospitals at the start of the war were woefully inadequate. My female nurses could only improve the situation, and I did not want them to be prevented from joining the effort, but there needed to be regulations, standards for them to be taken seriously. It was a full 3 months into the conflict before I was given the actual commission, but the work was quite grueling.
Well, I imagine the chaos of that period was...
Facilities had no supplies, few beds, assistants and other medical personnel resigning to join the Confederacy. There were not even field hospitals at battle sites. Wounded were wandering into Washington for aid, those that could still walk. No organized ambulance service, no system for even documenting a patient's whereabouts, and no standard of cleanliness or efficiency. All I had to create.
Wow, that must have been draining.
But the worst obstacle was resentment. I naturally met with resistance from men at all levels in my advocacy work for the insane. However, the unbridled indignation of military doctors and army staff, astonishing. My female nurses could only serve if there were already two male nurses assigned. Their wages were 40 cents a day with rations and housing, while male nurses earned almost 70 cents with rations and housing, but also clothing and medical care.
Oh.
And as I was assessing applications and determining assignments, the number of hospitals began to expand, until I was leaving Washington to do inspections and post nurses across the country.
Oh.
My duties were multiplying rapidly, and I strove to maintain my independent decision-making, which caused suspicion. I was dispensing my role without salary, as I insisted upon, so there would be no taint of selfishness. However, my presence and knowledge were quickly deemed a threat by the military heads and the Surgeon General, and my placement of nurses was interfered with until my post was actually legislated out from under me.
Oh, they took away your office?
They rewrote what my office was to have jurisdiction over, thus reducing my powers to recruit and place nurses till it was completely subservient to the whim of the incompetent Surgeon General.
Oh.
I continued my duties, but held no sway in inspection nor in remonstrance against abuses. It was, as I said, extremely demoralizing.
Oh, it was a devastating time for the country.
And my work therein is not what I would have my life judged by. We shall not continue to discuss it.
Okay, sure. So after the rebellion, did you go back to asylum work?
It was my desire to reaffirm my life's work after the debacle that was the war and its accompanying horrors. I was used to scenes of violence, abject filth, and foul living conditions. But what I had witnessed in the almshouses and prisons could not be compared to the devastatingly grim scenes in what we called hospitals during the war. The abominations of inhumanity, inflicted for reasons that were, in my mind, essentially politics, caused a rending of my very soul. I thought that leaving behind the war and returning to the asylums for my poor mad children would be cleansing. But I shall speak this, but with some grief. We are placed upon this earth to carry out a mission that we alone can fulfill. My work was to lead those from the dark into a light that purifies and offers hope of being healed.
Oh.
Treatment, such as what was promised in the hospitals that I established. Humane therapy, fresh air, dignity in work, in nutrition and surroundings to secure mental fortitude by replacing their miseries with kindness. This was certitude of help, there is no doubt. But what I saw as a simple equation is not so simple in execution. The ongoing funding required for sustained humane treatment demands a continuity of focus and an unflagging commitment to the patient. Without that commitment, purposeful pursuit of therapies and treatments will lapse once zeal and energy fail to be center stage. This is the real tragedy of my poor asylums. Without vigilance, the foxes picked off the chickens, feather by feather, until there was nothing but mangled parts strewn around. Good doctors were replaced with cheaper ones. Sufficient numbers of staff were reduced to skeleton crews populated by unqualified ignorance that packed patients in and ran the hospitals for profit, stripping all quality till the insane were almost exactly where they had been in the bleakest of almshouses and prisons when I started in 1841. 30 years of my work battling for progress only to discover my asylums were becoming houses of abuse.
What Weren't there some that were still okay?
But many were suffering from the one deplorable effect of depending on politics. The legislators are capricious, and seeing to the pauper insane is not glamorous. Money glitters better spent elsewhere. My asylums were financially starved of healing. They should be our best cure. But the wreckage that was left in the wake of the war and the abandonment of the state governments could not be remedied. These are lessons that one must learn, and learn to accept. I choose not to dwell on these aspects affected by time and society's shallowness of soul.
But you helped establish hospitals around the world, like in France and Turkey and even Japan, and certainly have helped many, many people.
I may gather some consolation from these things, yes.
And your name continues to be hailed as a great humanitarian, Miss Dix. I have to tell you that in our time, there was a U.S. Navy transport ship called the Dorothea Dix, and there's even a crater on Venus named after you.
Then I am remembered after all.
Absolutely. Your good work is not forgotten.
I have no need of accolades. That was never my desire. But on Venus, you say?
Yep. A crater named Dix.
Well, that is of some value. I am fatiguing. You have one more question.
Yes. We ask all our interviewees this. What do you think is the definition of women's work? What does it mean to you, and is there a difference between men and women with regard to work?
An unusual and intriguing question. Yes, work entails definable skill. I believe when we are called, whether woman or man, quite appropriately, the type of service required is determined by the type of person. However, it is evident that some are called upon to suffer greatly, but also to serve greatly, such as myself. The commission handed to me from above, I am convinced, was a path exceedingly narrow, straight, and heavy laden, hardly the kind of endeavor expected of a mere woman. Yet for me to eschew it would be nothing less than betrayal. Though it appeared impossible when I began, unassailable, yet with God's divine assistance, this weakest of flesh was able to strive where even men had previously been unsuccessful. The worker must persevere.
No matter the odds.
Because we are each of us given a job to do with no time to waste. That is my definition. Press on. Do not dawdle in the completion of your task, whatever it may be.
Well, very sound advice.
I have been fortunate. No one could be totally free.
There goes the connection. Thank you, Miss Dix. We really appreciate your time. I had so many other things to ask her.
The wall has gone silent. Jeffrey, we should make sure those patients teaching themselves cricket have done no damage to the azaleas.
Women's Work is a production of Tri-Pi Theater and its collaborators. Our themes today are political action, social reform, mental health and human services, the legislative process, the Civil War, the American humanitarian movement, and, of course, women's history. We are grateful to all our sponsors and listeners for their support, to you, and to you too. I'm your host, Leslie Gray, with John Nabori, our sound designer. Special thanks to the incredible Phyllis Elliott as Dorothea Dix. Thanks for tuning in to Women's Work. Encourage a girl to succeed. Until next time, do good, and do be humble.